Alright, this is Elliot Serrano, May 14th, around 2 o'clock, sitting in a room with Cory Doctorow. We're going to talk about Little Brother, his new book, among other things. Cory, thanks for having me.
Oh, not at all, my pleasure.
And right before I turned the tape on you, you made a very valid comment, I felt, on well, the type of feedback you've been getting from teenagers in regards to Little Brother. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, so I've been getting a ton of email from young teenagers saying, you know, I'm not the world's most techie person, but I found the tech stuff easy enough to follow, and it inspired me to go look up some more stuff. And that's the key thing, is that pretty much all the information you need and as much detail as you need it is available for free online. It's the thing is that we don't know what to look for. So what I hope that, you know, Little Brother, some of the tech stuff would actually teach people stuff, but mostly it would inspire them to know which questions they need to ask of the internet in order to get some pretty interesting answers.
A lot of the technology all the technology that you feature in Little Brother is based on reality. It's nothing so far out, like most science fiction, where it's very speculative. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in Little Brother that, I guess, because I was trying to research this myself, like the Xbox Universal, did that really exist, or did you create that?
Well, I made it up, but it's a pretty logical extrapolation, right? I mean, the business model of the Xbox is to take locked hardware, sell it at a discount, and then charge companies for the right to put software on the locked hardware, and the lock allows you to prevent companies that haven't paid from shipping software. And so the cheaper the locked hardware is, the more people there are who have it, the more attractive it will be to software companies, the more you can charge for the right to deploy software to it. So it seems like a pretty obvious thought that at some point Microsoft or someone like them might just give away some locked hardware with the hopes of selling software. In fact, you know, mobile phones are that, right? If you think about mobile phones, yeah, they provide a service layer as well, but the whole point of a locked mobile phone and locking what code you can run on a mobile phone is this kind of bizarre little racket where, you know, in order to run software on your own phone, someone else needs to give you permission. And, you know, with some phones, they can even deinstall software after you've installed it. Like the Sidekicks, they uninstalled a bunch of games a couple of years ago when they broke off paying license fees to the companies that made the games. So it's a little odd. You know, if you think about, like, if you bought a Nintendo and you bought some games for your Nintendo, if Nintendo and the company that made the games fell out later on, you wouldn't expect that company to come over to your house and take away your games, right? It's like not really your problem what they and Nintendo are doing. But but that's kind of the locked platform business model. And there's a certain kind of dirty monopolist that it appeals to. And it seemed pretty plausible to assume that that might actually be a business model in the near future.
Don't you think, in a way, you could be inadvertently giving them certain ideas?
Oh, I'm sure this has already occurred to them. You know, Microsoft is really interesting because it illustrates how an institution can be made up of great people who nevertheless collectively do things that aren't so great. So, mm-hmm. You know, you notice that there's a dust jacket quote on this book from Ray Ozzie, who's the chief software architect at Microsoft, and a friend of mine, and as nice and good and honorable a person as you can hope to meet. He's Bill Gates' successor. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to shift the course of Microsoft, it's really tough. I've seen a lot of people batter themselves to death on that cliff, you know. And there are a lot of institutions like that. A friend of mine once described trying to change the BBC as like trying to change the course of a battleship by tapping it on the nose with a toothpick.
Oh, goodness. The XNet, and also an intriguing concept, harkens back to, say, the Underground Railroad and symbolically and in other things. Is that something that you were trying to achieve with that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's long been a goal of people who are interested in and believe in the importance of communicating in private to get more people to take privacy seriously, and not just for altruistic reasons, but when you're the only one whose communications are secure, you kind of stand out in the crowd. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it becomes the norm that everyone communicates securely, then you are less likely to be fingered as someone potentially doing something that requires further investigation. The other thing, of course, is that all communications have two ends, right? And so if your end is secure and the other guy's end isn't, then you're not secure either. So, you know, you might opt out of using Gmail because you think that their data mining is a little scary, But if you send email to people who use Gmail, then you're still using Gmail, right? All that email is sitting there on their side of the communication. So, you know, my hope was to inspire kids to understand that it's in their interest to take their privacy more seriously, not just for their sake, but for my own.
Mm-hmm. As an aside, I know when I read Boing Boing, and you all have your public keys, mm-hmm. Zenny has her on her site, and mm-hmm. I'm still. You explain that in the book, the concept behind public and
dual
private
key cryptography.
Key cryptography. Could you, like, let's say to the layman who
sure.
just doesn't seem to get it?
Sure. So the magic part that you have to understand a lot of math to get, and that I'm not going to try and explain in detail, but just you're going to have to just take it for granted. Mm-hmm. So there are ways of scrambling messages that can't be unscrambled unless you have the key, right? So you just got to take that for granted. Mm-hmm. Mathematicians can show that this is true. And there's a special kind of scrambling system in which you use one key to scramble and the other key to descramble and vice versa. So what one key scrambles, the other key descrambles. So far, so good?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So now imagine that we take one of those keys and we publish it. And we take the other key and we keep it secret. And we all do this. And so through some mechanism, I can always find out what your public key is. You can always find out what my public key is. If I take a message and scramble it with my private key and send it to you, you can use my public key to unscramble it, and then you'll know that I must have signed it in the first. I must have scrambled it in the first place because only my private key will scramble a message in such a way that my public key will descramble it. So you have a kind of secure signature mechanism. So you know that whoever sent that message had possession of my private key. It was presumably me, although maybe I let my private key leak, right? But you can assume kind of in this kind of platonic simplified example it was me. Now, if I take the message and first I scramble it with my key, public key, and then I scramble it with your public key, that means that no one else except you can descramble it because you're the only one who has your private key. And then once you've descrambled it, you descramble it again using my public key and you know that no one but me could have sent it. And now we have in one package a secure mechanism for me to send you a secure message that no one else can intercept or change, that you can verify came from me, and that you can verify no one else has read. So that's pretty cool. And then all the rest is details, right? How do you know that my key is my key? How do I know that your key is your key? What do we do about revoking keys? What do we do about... Well, those are kind of the big ones, actually. It's verifying keys and knowing which key is which. But I can do something like, I can take your public key, and I can scramble my public key with it, and then send it to you. And then when you receive it, you know that no one else could have intercepted it en route, so you know that my public key was sent to you securely. Right? So that's one of the advantages of having public keys widely available. And it's interesting because it turns the security problem on its head. Usually when you're trying to communicate in secret, your biggest problem is how to keep the general world from finding out about your message. But when you start talking about public key cryptography, the problem becomes the reverse. It's how to make sure that people know what your key is, right? It's like you've gone from being someone who wants to communicate in secret from someone who wants into being someone who wants to be like a broadcaster. Right, who wants to put the message in every corner of the world, because the more people there are who know exactly what your public key is, the harder it is for people to spoof your messages or intercept your messages or whatever. So it's a kind of hairy problem, but it's got a lot of cool and interesting solutions people have come up with.
Like Marcus would say in the book, how can you get everyone to know about a certain kind of shampoo?
Right.
And they spend billions of dollars
trying to
advertise that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of hard. It's like, as hard as it is to keep a secret, it's sometimes hard to disclose it, too. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, so one of the things that happens in this book is they do something called key signing. So imagine that you and I have met, and I've given you my key. So you know that it's my key because I gave it to you, and you trust me. Now, I meet someone else. What I can do is I can take my key and scramble their key with it, and then I can send it to you. And you can know that only I could have scrambled that key. And if you believe that I'm not screwing you over and scrambling someone else's, you know, scrambling Alice's key and telling you it's Bob's key, if you believe that when I say this is Alice's key, I can send you the key electronically, and you'll know that this is Alice's key so far as Corey says. And then Alice, if you trust Alice because I trust Alice, Alice can scramble Bob's key and sign it with her key. And since you know that Alice's key is Alice's key because you got the signature from me, now you trust Bob's key too. And that's called transitive trust. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the ways that we solve key signing. You can send out signed messages that say, I revoke my key. So you can say, this key has been compromised, or I lost it, or whatever. Actually, what you do usually when you create the key is you create another file that is a revocation message that's signed by the key, and you keep that separate from the key. And if you lose the key, you can just send out that file, and it's verifiably generated with a private key, and it says, I revoke my key. And now everyone knows that someone who's probably you says, this key, this old key is no good, and then you might publish a new key.
Yeah, Will Wheaton says he prefers cryptographic messages, and I looked into that during. I just wanted to send them an email, and
once you've got it installed, yeah. It's pretty straightforward, though. I mean, it took me about 10 minutes to set up with Firefox or Thunderbird and Ubuntu, and another 2 minutes to generate the key, and now it literally doesn't require that I do anything except click assign this message and enter my passphrase.
Okay.
So it's pretty straightforward.
Okay, cool. I'll have to look into that. You said that little brother initially was going to be a first of two. Is that still the plan?
Yeah, no, it's not going to be anymore. Basically, I finished the book and left it on a cliffhanger and left room for it to have a sequel. And both my editor and my agent thought that this was a terrible idea. So I rewrote the last 10%. Oh. They thought, yeah, and I'm inclined to agree with them in that kind of in the long run. But it was going to have a sequel called Big Brother.
Big Brother. I would be interested to see like the story from, say, Masha and Zeb's point of view.
Yeah, that wasn't... Well, there was going to be a lot more MASH and Zeb. They were going to go to L.A. and meet up with old counterculture people who had also been underground. And he and Ange were going to break up, and Ange was going to end up living on a commune, and she was going to back down from being radical, and she was going to plan on spending the rest of her life living underground, and it would be about his struggle to come out. And there was the second bit was going to be more about ARGs and geocaching, and a lot of it was going to be set in Disneyland.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, so it was kind of my crazy idea for a sequel, but I'm kind of glad because I don't really write sequels. I really like writing new stuff from scratch. Mm-hmm. So
okay. So speaking of Disneyland, and this is a complete aside, but did you ever find any more of that haunted mansion swag that you lost as a kid?
No, I've never found it.
No.
No.
I read that. It broke my heart.
I keep telling people totally about it in the hopes that someone will come forward and say, you know, I have one of those.
Oh, what? I'm just curious. Well, what? So I can...
It was, the specific thing were these cards. They were just, they were like cardstock, about that big. And they had pictures, line art pictures of slightly sinister looking, very prim Victorian men and women. And they'd been painted with transparent, luminescent paint of vampires and werewolves. And so when you expose them to light and then brought them into the dark, these Victorian men and women would turn into werewolves, vampires, and zombies.
Oh, wow.
And they were really cool. They were literally pieces of card about that big, and there were, like, I think 4 of them. Mm-hmm. And by the time I went back again a couple of years later, they weren't on sale anymore, and they've never offered them for sale since. I've never seen them on eBay. They just sort of vanished. And you can understand that, right? It's just card stock, so it's the kind of thing that just gets crumpled up and lost.
Wow. It broke my heart when I read that.
Thank you.
It broke my heart. Back to Little Brother, because there's an interesting little history lesson that the social studies teacher gives about the civil rights movement, the 60s, 70s, the hippies and the yippies.
Mm-hmm. And yippies, of course, got their start or had their watershed moment here in Chicago in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have that famous quote with Mayor Daley saying that the police are not here to
create disorder; they're here to preserve disorder. Yeah.
Oh, we gotta love that. Well, you had your hippies and your yippies. What would you call today's generation of nerd that's interested in civil rights and in the freedom of information and such? If you take nerds and hippies, you get nerpies, which sounds like a sounds like a disease.
Herpes. You know, I don't know. I don't know that I have a good portmanteau word for them, but I call myself a technology activist. you know, I'm an activist about the characteristics of technology, and I'm an activist about using technology as a means to, as a lever to change society. But and I think it is a dual-edged thing. You have to, on the one hand, be concerned with the disposition of the tools that you use, and on the other, with what those tools can accomplish.
There was a lot, especially when you talk about cryptography and how information can be compromised. I was thinking a lot about how the current intelligence system works with us trying to figure out what other countries are doing. And all it takes is somebody in the middle to just fudge with a few things here and there to completely change the landscape. I think John le Carré has explored that a bit in some of his spy books, where you can have someone who's in the intelligence community compromising that. Do you think that's a real concern today?
Well, I think that there are definitely real, no-fooling, live-on-the-ground intelligence concerns that relate to the security of people who live in countries and Western democracies. I don't doubt it for a second. And technology can help with some of that stuff. But I actually think that a lot of what we think of as intelligence concerns concern things that are pretty public. You know, it's not the same thing it's not the same kind of intelligence concern that we used to weigh on our minds. This isn't about so much about what people say in secret. It's about how people conduct themselves in public spaces that we are all a participant in via the internet. It is really an interesting and unique situation that all the adversaries, no matter what side they're on, are using the same internet to communicate, and that any tool that compromises one compromises all of them. In some ways, I hope that actually will drive the internet to be an environment where privacy is easier to maintain, because it's in everyone's interest to do so.
Then you have all those movements within the U.S. government in regulating the internet. Mm-hmm. Who gets the best service? Who can get the most information through? Who has to wait in line?
Well, this is the whole network neutrality question, and it's a really important one. The arguments for prioritizing some kinds of data over others in order to make sure that certain applications run or that some people don't hog the network have at their core a couple of really bad assumptions. The first is that the most technologically efficient way to make sure that everything that everyone's trying to do on the internet happens is to throttle some people instead of, and give their bandwidth to other people. And that's not been borne out by the research. The people who run Internet2, which is this academic high-speed backbone network that has built-in quality of service mechanisms and lots of tuning technologies to help them manage contention on networks, they concluded that it's always cheaper to add more capacity than it is to try and screw around with the capacity you have to compensate for the fact that you don't have enough of it. It's just always cheaper to build out more capacity. And the other thing is that the phone companies and other network carriers should have the right to arrange the network in such a way as to maximize their profits, because after all, they're for-profit entities. And it's true that they're for-profit entities, but they are for-profit entities that enjoy an enormous amount of public windfall, right? Imagine that you were the phone company and you were starting out today, and instead of the government saying to you, yes, we're going to give you the statutory capacity to dig up all of our roads and run wires into everyone's houses, you're going to have to purchase that right-of-way foot by foot, yard by yard, from everyone who owns property between, you know, here and the Wisconsin border. But the cost of building that phone network would run into the quadrillions, right? So the only way that they can build that network is with the public giving them access to a resource that would cost billions of dollars. And moreover, the public gives them exclusive access to that resource, right? We don't let everyone put a wire in the ground. We let one or two or maybe three sometimes companies put wires in the ground. To say that having been the recipient of that public largesse, you have no responsibility to operate in the public interest is really completely bogus. And when you hear the telco companies saying we have the right to, or don't regulate the internet, don't overregulate us. I mean, it's the most rank hypocrisy, right? All a telephone company is a bunch of regulation wrapped up in greed, right? I mean, they are utterly and absolutely creatures of regulation. So to say, oh, well, we don't want any regulation, you know, don't over-regulate the internet, it's just crap. You know, there are some interesting technical questions about what is and isn't neutral and so on, but none of those are the meat. You know, the meat is that when you buy a network connection, you are buying it with the understanding that your service provider is going to give you the packets you ask for as quickly as they can, given the technology that they own. Not that they're going to use the fact that they own your connection to extort money from some third party in exchange for preferential access to you. Right? Craig Engler, I'm blanking on his surname, the guy who founded Craigslist, Craig, starts with an N. Craig. Craig has a lovely analogy. He says, imagine you pick up the phone, you call the corner pizzeria, and they say, the corner pizzeria has not paid for premium service, so even though their line is free, you will have to wait for 1 minute. However, Domino's has paid for premium service. We can connect your call immediately. Right? That would be a less good phone company. Right? Mm-hmm. I think most of us understand that that's not what we're paying the phone company for. But that's what they're proposing to do with our network connections, and that's in fact what some of them are doing with our network connections. It has all the dignity of being traded to another prisoner for two packs of cigarettes, right? I mean, you know, to be used as a pawn in someone's extortion racket is not really what you're paying for when you shell out money for your broadband.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's a great way of putting it. It's a great analogy. I was reading online about the book being released. You've compared it to, you've called it Encyclopedia Brown meets the Anarchist Cookbook.
Yeah.
I think it's an excellent way of
Or Wikipedia Brown, or the other one is Neuromancer meets Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Exactly, because the first two...
Chicago reference.
So. Pretty much, right. Because the first two chapters, it felt like a Ferris Bueller, and then it takes that really dark turn right after that, and which I totally didn't see coming. But, okay, so... That being said, are you concerned that you're on the DHS terror watch list?
Well, you know, I hope that if it happens that I will be able to use the mechanisms of democracy to address it. I mean, it would be a pretty piss poor way of answering my charge that the DHS are agents of totalitarian repression to censor me and kick me out of the country, right? This is, no, we're not here to repress free speech and shut up and get out of the country. You know, if nothing else, I think it'd probably sell a lot of books.
Because one of the comments on the message board was someone said, I didn't think of it that way, and should I have been concerned carrying it through the terminal,
right? I'll tell you, I don't carry it when I fly to the country. I don't carry it in my suitcase when I come into the country.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I figure if I get pulled into customs and they want to investigate me, that maybe they'll Google me and find it and say, oh, this is a bad deal for America. But I don't have to make that easy. I just turn up and with whatever reading material I'm reading, but not with that.
What do you normally carry with you?
Well, there's a stack of books over there.
Okay.
That's my reading material for the tour. I'm researching a book that's set partly in India and partly in China, so I'm doing a lot of reading about both countries.
Okay. Well, on to some lighter topics. Harajuku Fun Madness gets a ton of Googling done after the book, and a lot of folks are disappointed to find that it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Where'd the idea come for that?
Well, just from ARGs, and from the fact that... let's see, when did I start this book? I guess we'd been home from Japan for like 6 months when I started this book, so I was pretty much missing Japan, because we went on a trip last year and the year before too. We're going again this September. My wife goes every year for the Tokyo Game Show because she works in video games. It just seemed, I guess part of the inspiration was what, there's a great sociologist at MIT who started the comparative media studies program called Henry Jenkins. He talks about the phenomenon of the lowbrow cosmopolitan teen. So highbrow cosmopolitans know what's on the opera in Milan this year. A lowbrow cosmopolitan knows what they're wearing on Harajuku Bridge this year. And he says, you can walk into a 7-Eleven in, East Bumblefuck, Iowa, and there will be a kid behind the counter, 16 years old, who will know more about anime than, the most ardent Japanologist would have at a university 5 years ago. And that, teens have become global in this really interesting cultural way. And I thought it'd be kind of cool to experiment with you know, kids whose interests are really global, you know, who don't make sharp distinctions between domestic and foreign pop culture.
And that was one thing that I was fascinated by. So I'm reading the book and wondering, okay, so which of it is fictional, which is real? The case where there was video posted of a general being basically abused.
No, that never happened. But again, it's the kind of thing that, you know, there have been lots of examples of people going through airport checkpoints mm-hmm. who are decorated veterans mm-hmm. or heads of state, Nelson Mandela, you know, who've been stopped, who've been forced to get waivers, who've mm-hmm. been sent back. You know, there have been soldiers required to give up their medals. There was a soldier. There are stories, recurring stories, of soldiers who are going off to war on civilian transport, because sometimes they use civilian jets to travel, who are going through the checkpoint with their guns, and also a pocket knife and a bottle of water, and who are having their pocket knife and bottle of water confiscated, because those aren't allowed on airplanes, but their carbines are allowed on airplanes. And, you know, it's one of those things where you say, well, we hope that our anti-terror apparatus is, flexible, nimble, sharp-witted, able to respond intelligently to dynamic situations, and, you know, at least as dynamic as a terror cell, right? And then they do stuff like this, and you think, holy moly, right? How can these people ever hope to stop, you know, small, nimble, flexible terrorist cells when they're not either capable as a matter of policy or as a matter of mental capacity of understanding that it makes no sense to take away the water bottle of a soldier who's carrying a loaded rifle onto an airplane, loaded repeating rifle and machine gun onto an airplane.
Oh boy, you're right. Do you consider yourself? I know you've probably heard this question before. Do you consider yourself a science fiction writer, a speculative fiction writer?
No, just science fiction is good enough for me. I gave up on all those definitional questions a long time ago. You can call it speculative fiction, you can call it sci-fi, you can call it SF. Just keep on reading. I'm way more concerned with whether or not people are reading it than what they're calling it.
Warren Ellis is tossing about slipstream as a new term.
Whatever. Slipstream is actually, it's an old term. It comes from Bruce Sterling and the zine Cheap Truth in the 80s. So it's not even a new movement. Right. You know, this stuff is all those word games are awfully fun. You know, mm-hmm. interstitial fiction is one I like. But at the end of the day, you know, I just want people to read it.
Which is why you release a lot of your work for free under Creative Commons.
All of it, all my books.
All the books. And I know you've heard the current state of your work being read under that guideline, under that plan. You're giving it away for free, and a lot of folks would say, why give it away when you want people to buy it? How has that, up to date, how has that affected your numbers as far as selling books?
Well, the only way to answer that comprehensively would be to go back in time in a time machine and re-release the same books without the CC license and see how it can compare the sales. So the only good empirical stuff I can give you is, like, my publishers are happy with it. They consistently reprint my work because it sells out the print runs, which print runs are indicative of what a publisher who has their finger on the pulse of how books sell think your book is going to sell. So when you sell out your print run and they go back for another one, it means that someone who's better equipped than just about anyone to guess how many copies you were going to sell was wrong and underestimated, and so you're selling better than their expectation. Another good indicator that I like is that there are lots of people who've tried CC releases of their work, and all the people who've done it, who released another work, did it again, right?
Okay.
So, you know, that's a pretty good market signal, right? It's not quantifiable, but there are some qualifiable indicators in the market that people who have done CC releases given their best guesses of how their books would have sold without the CC release, believe that the CC release helps.
So it's not by any means hurting sales?
No, I mean, not as far as anyone can work out. Right. I mean, you know, I keep some tabs, like how many people write to me and say, I loved your book, I found it electronically, and then I went out and bought a copy, versus how many people write to me and say, ha ha, you stupid hippie, I would have bought your book, but I got it for free, and, you know, it's kind of one in 10,000.
Wow. science fiction in other mediums. What do you think about the current state of science fiction and say on television?
Well, so one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that science fiction in visual media, like TV and audiovisual media, like TV and film, I think it tends to be egregiously stupid about the technology, right? Tends to make the technology do stuff that technology just doesn't do for no good reason, right? It does not enhance the plot. It doesn't make the movies better, and it's just wrong in like these really grating ways. You know, the computer that clicks every time you press a key, that there's, you know, some software that makes the computer go click, 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 or beep, 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 beep every time you press a key. You know, these operating systems that just draw one giant window on the screen to be more convenient for you know, the camera to catch sight of. You know, email addresses that aren't routable as email addresses. Email addresses that end in @ instead of, you know, .com or .org or, you know, .au or whatever. That kind of thing just drives me completely bonkers. One of the things I wanted to do with this book was make a book in which it was a genuine techno thriller. It was something where you really were on the edge of your seat wondering how things were going to work out, because great struggles were taking place using high technology in which all the technological details were plausible. Mm. Right? There was nothing in it that was just, like, just, you know, where I just egregiously gone out and said, yes, I know it works this way, but it won't work this way in this book because it will make a better shot, you know? That was a fun exercise to undertake. I really wish more movies were better about that stuff.
Have you been approached to work on anything, like to pitch for TV or movies?
You know, I lived in LA all last year. I had this Fulbright at USC, and you often get approached by entertainment industry people. I'm actually consulting on a couple of nonfiction films, documentary films, but the thing about the entertainment industry, Hollywood in particular, is that they're like always trembling on the verge of doing something. So people will call you up and say, you know, I'm just about to close this deal. I'd really love to have you to be a part of it. I want to option your thing, and I'd like to take the option now, and I'll have the financing in a month, and so on. And you know, I've got a film agent. He's very enthusiastic, and he goes around and he shops my stuff very aggressively, and he tells me that we're very close to a deal, but nothing's final till it's final. And until I've got a signed contract and a check, I don't take any of it very seriously.
Okay. And you've been doing some stuff with IDW. They've been taking some of your stories and making them into comics. How do you feel about how that's been going?
Those were really good. And actually, later this month, they're releasing the trade paperback edition. And we're going to CC release it at the same time. And I actually signed 6,000 tip-in sheets for it that are going to be bound in with it. Just before leaving London to come to Chicago, it was brutal. My arms still hurt from all that signing. It was crazy. But yeah, they're all signed and in Korea, being bound into the book, and they'll have it at Book Expo America at the end of the month, which I'm going to be flying out to LA for. I was really happy with how that stuff turned out. There's something very humbling about having that many really talented, smart people take your work and do great things with it.
Have you thought about writing comics yourself?
Yeah, I wrote a little comic, actually. I wrote an 8-page story for the last installment of the limited edition Kitchen Sink Press Haunted Mansion comic.
Oh, okay.
It hasn't come out yet. It's coming out this summer. I was one of the guests of honor at Comic-Con last year in San Diego, and I went to their booth, and I saw their Haunted Mansion comic, and I was like, I love this. I'm a huge Haunted Mansion fan. You know, my first novel is all about the Haunted Mansion. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you ever thought about writing for comics? And I said, well, yeah, a little bit. And they're like, well, we have 8 pages left in the last issue that we haven't filled. Do you want to try writing a story? So I wrote an 8-page story for the last issue, very much inspired by, like, Mad Magazine. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to try writing some comics at some point. I've got a novel to finish and then a nonfiction book to write, and then maybe I'll try it out.
Okay. Because if I read correctly, you did a Star Wars fanfic when you were 6 years old.
6 years old, yeah.
Ever any interest in doing something with Star Wars?
No. I've never had any interest beyond that in being a sharecropper in someone else's universe.
Okay. You said that when you were young, you read Daniel Pinkwater. And that really opened your mind.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to that 13-year-old who's now read Little Brother and looks at you the same way you looked at Pinkwater's work, what do you say to them?
I say, here's a bibliography. Right? Here's the 100 things that influenced me, which is actually in that book. Mm-hmm. Go read that stuff now, because this should just be a starting point.
I have a couple kind of funny things I wanted to maybe throw at you, if you didn't mind.
Yeah.
Questions. Geek versus nerd.
No preference.
No preference, but, well. Would you rather be at ARGing or at Space Camp?
Space Camp.
If they existed, would you rather have a wand or a lightsaber?
Wand.
A wand.
You could make a lightsaber with a wand.
Ah, good one. Good one. Tolkien or Heinlein?
Heinlein.
Heinlein? Leia or Seven of Nine?
Leia.
Leia?
Okay. Never been a Trek fan.
Never been a Trek fan. Neither have I. All right, so then you're split the difference there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and Carrie Fisher, of course, has the Chicago connection, Blues
right.
Brothers.
Right.
Daniel Pinkwater, too, you know, he's a Chicago.
Yes.
So
yes.
Yeah. Chicagoan. Sorry.
No, by all means. You're the easiest interview ever. The answer to the question no one ever asks.
The answer to the question no one ever asks. The last line of The Pit and the Pendulum.
Awesome. I'm not going to ask that, because
right.
I could always look it up.
Well, look it up, and then have a look at Little Brother.
Little Brother, okay.